Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the chat.
Hi.
I'm sorry you've got me. I'm not Flipper, but needs must. And I feel really privileged, to be honest, because I watch and follow you and all that you do. So I'm so pleased to be just filling in. I'm going to give everybody a brief introduction who may not know you. And if I forget anything or we've left anything out, please add it in too. So Amanda is a woman who wears many hats within the field. She is the lead diabetes specialist nurse at, I'll take a deep breath, East Kent Hospitals University NHS Foundation Trust. My word, that's a long name.
We call it ECHAFT.
Ah, that's good. I was like, how do you introduce it? Like, oh my gosh. Amanda does not leave diabetes at the door though when she gets home. Her son was diagnosed with type 1 in 2015, and then herself, she was diagnosed in 2020 with type 1 as an adult. Amanda helped found and run the diabetes specialist forum that many of us love and participates in many initiatives helping educate and spreading good practice. She's a founding member of the incredible Diabetes 101 set up at the start of the pandemic to support the diabetes community, both emotionally and provide verified information. It helps so many people. Amanda was nominated for and won the Quality and Care Diabetes Healthcare Professional of the Year in 2019, and also was part of teams which won two more QIC awards. You are an ultra marathon runner in diabetes, and it is such a pleasure to have you on the chat.
Well, thank you.
Is there any?
My head's getting really big now.
I'm sure there's other things we haven't even mentioned. Like, I was listening to the podcast there this week, and like, you and Beth are a hoot, really. Fair. You're brilliant and really informative too, in a really normal way. It's so good. I know that Tom is going to do the quickfire 90. They're not 90 seconds, but like, they're the quick fire questions.
Okay. We say this every week, 90 second questions, and they last about 10 minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
I think we like to talk here on a diabetes chat, but basically it's just to get to know you a little bit more, and then we're going to get into the juicy bits and talk about your journey with diabetes and when you were diagnosed, but also talking about parenting and your son's journey with diabetes and how you parent. And then we'll come back to me later on, I believe, and talk about the DSN forum and stuff like that. But let's go. Obviously, we know who you are, but what is your occupation, your main occupation, Amanda?
So I am the lead diabetes nurse for a big hospital trust in Kent. So we're one of the largest trusts in the country. There's three big hospitals and two smaller hospitals. So I'm the lead diabetes nurse for the whole trust. So I kind of line manage all of the diabetes teams in the hospital. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
At what age were you diagnosed with diabetes, and how old was your son when he was diagnosed?
So I was 40, which is, I know people think it's a childhood condition, and people always think that 40, it must be type 2, which, you know, a lot of people who are diagnosed at 40 is type 2 diabetes, but I have a very strong family history, and so I had antibodies tested straight away, and obviously they came back positive. Mm-hmm. I forgot the rest of the question.
And when was, how old was your son when he was diagnosed?
He was 7. Yeah, 7 years old.
And who got diagnosed first, yourself or your son?
Him. Yeah, him.
Wow. For some reason, I thought it would have been the other way around. I don't know why, but I just assumed.
But, yeah.
Wow.
There's a lot of people like it, actually. There's a lot of people who, children have diabetes and then they get diagnosed as an adult later. So I've met a few people like that, actually.
Yeah. Do you finger prick or use sensors to check your levels? What do you use?
So I had the Libre, but then I tried the Dexcom one, and I'm currently messing about with stuff with an expired G6. and that Dexcom One sensors, which I probably shouldn't say.
But, I can't cut that out.
No, you've got to do these kind of tests, haven't you? Because otherwise, then you know what, when people come and tell you they're doing all these random things with DIY stuff, you got to know what they're up to. So I think trialing it on myself.
Testing, I
just use myself as a guinea pig.
And we see all the amazing things coming with commercial closed looping and all that. But without the DIY community, all these sort of things wouldn't be where we're at now, I guess. Like the DIY community have really allowed this to happen so soon, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you can't hide away from it. They're miles ahead, aren't they, DIY, to what's going on because they have to go through all these tests and things. It takes like 7 years to get any kind of medical device through all the hoops that they have to jump through. So the DIYers will be a lot further ahead, but we're digressing now, sorry.
It's all good. This is why it doesn't last 90 seconds, and that's why it needs a new name, guys. We keep seeing it every week, but we can't think of a name. Do you use
the 90 million seconds?
Yeah, maybe.
How many minutes will that be? Work it out. Do you use insulin pens or pump? What do you prefer and why?
So I have a T-Slim. So I think I prefer it because just getting injections out in public. I just remember this one time when I did it in a restaurant, this woman just staring at me. And you get a pump out and no one bats an eyelid. Yeah. When you get an injection out, they're like, and it's off-putting, isn't it? And it's kind of, the injections themselves weren't too much of an issue, but I just, when, especially as also, it's going to sound really bad. I wear a uniform to work. So I wear a nurse's outfit and I wear tights, and trying to find somewhere to inject without completely, you know, getting undressed and showing everyone, you know, it's just so awkward.
Yeah.
So pump is just,
there's only your arms.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't see what I'm doing. And yeah, it's just a pain. So yeah.
I think we've all been in them situations. Well, I've definitely not wore tights, but I mean, been in them situations where people are looking across the room and them sort of things. And I think with tech now, it's advancing again, bringing it back, is things are evolving where things will be on your phone and stuff. And people on their phones quite a lot. So people just bolusing from their phone and stuff. How cool is that? So tech has really changed, isn't it? And people won't even know them sort of things. Do you have symptoms of hypos? And if so, what are your hypo symptoms?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite in range a lot of the time, so I don't have very many hypos, but when I do, it's probably feel a bit drunk like dazed and a bit like nervous. Does that make sense?
You feel
it in your stomach, feel a bit like, oh, what's happening? That's all I can explain it, like drunk.
So
tipsy.
So what would be your go-to hypo treatment when you're feeling a bit tipsy?
I carry dextro tabs with me everywhere I go. Yeah, because they're just easy, aren't they? Apart from my dog has now decided that she likes dextro tabs, and anytime I leave them laying around, she's at the packet.
Does she find the remnants? Oh my gosh! Does she turn like super hypo? Like hyper? Sorry.
No.
Like...
Oh, she's already hyper anyway. She don't need much.
No, not much more. What do you think's worse for you, Amanda? Feeling hypo or hyper? And same for your son as well. What do you think he would say?
I would say hypo. Because you just feel a bit out of control, don't you? You just feel a bit like, with my son, I would say the same, because he doesn't even notice when he's really high.
we'll get on to that in
the parenting.
Absolutely. One thing you like about diabetes and one thing you don't like about diabetes?
I don't like that my son has it. You know, when he was diagnosed, I was like, you know, you want to take it away from them. You want to have it, but there was no deal where I got it and he still has it.
So you wanted to take it off him. So you did.
Yeah.
You actually got but you still got it. Right.
That was not the deal.
No, you didn't sign that contract. It was in the small print, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the diabetes community is massive, isn't it? In not just when you have diabetes, but in the healthcare professional community, it's like everybody knows everybody, everybody's good friends, everybody, you know, like we could never have set up the Diabetes 101 if we didn't have such amazing people work in diabetes that could be part of it.
And I'm sure later on we might hear from Kez, because I know Kez, who is a massive factor for you, the Diabetes 101 community. So I'm sure we'll hear that later. Do you have any feelings towards the smell of insulin? Do you love it, hate it, or not bothered?
Indifferent.
Indifferent. There we go. And if you're on a desert island, just a bit of fun, just get to know you a little bit more. What three items would you take? And you've got all your diabetes kit, so that's all there. You've got your your hypo treatments and everything. So what three things would you take?
Can you take people?
Yeah, you can take Beth, because
Beth, obviously she's coming. That's a no-brainer, because we are the same person apparently.
That's a given, right?
Yeah. Does that still count if we're the same person? And maybe you like Ray Mears or someone. But, you know, we're on a desert island. I want someone who knows what they're doing.
Brilliant stuff.
Some Diet Coke. I have an addiction.
we should record all these 90-second questions, Mary, and especially this last question, to see the vast difference of what people choose. It'd be so interesting, wouldn't it?
Oh, I think so. We could do a natural language kind of deep dive into it as
it would,
well.
Wouldn't it? It would. All right. So thank you so much, Amanda. That gives us a bit of an insight into you a little bit more. Thank you so much. We are now going to hand over to Mary, and she's going to talk to you about your journey with diabetes and parenting and lots of interesting stuff. So over to you, Mary. I'm going to go and eat my I've literally naturally started eating my second ginger nut. I didn't even, you know, when you just.
You didn't know?
No, I didn't know. I just started doing it. Anyway, carry on. I'm just going to go eat some more.
We'll just hear some crunching in the background.
Absolutely.
It's great that they're fresh.
Absolutely, yes. Don't you hate when they're soggy? You don't like soggy ginger nuts, biscuits.
Disappointing having to take the first two out of the packet just because they're just disappointing. Yeah. All right, Amanda, we're going to chat a little bit about your diagnoses. And I think we'll maybe start with your son's, because we're going in chronological order.
Yeah, I mean, I have two other family members with type 1, so they were even before my son, so I don't know if you want to start
there. Yes.
Okay.
Tell us about them.
Okay, so the first person was my brother. He was 28 when he got diagnosed, and they first diagnosed him as type 2. He had all the classic symptoms of type 1. But GPs diagnosed him as type 2, started him on tablets and whatnot. Obviously, he wasn't type 1, 2, he was type 1. And within a few days, it was very evident that it wasn't type 2. I don't think he made it to DKA, but he was very, like, blurry eyesight, you know, really all the classic symptoms.
Is he older than you or younger?
Yeah, he's 2 years older than me.
And were you nursing at the time too?
Okay. No, not at that time. So I started my training, because I started my training as an adult sort of like after I had my children. So I didn't start nursing until I was 26, 27. Okay. So I was just about to start. I think it was like my access course, just about to start my nurse training when he got diagnosed. Yeah, I didn't really know anything about diabetes at the time. You know, you hear about things in the news, but you don't, you know, wasn't a nurse. I was just starting my training, so I didn't really know much about it. So I kind of learned a little bit from him, but he was, what's the way to say this? Not the best person to manage his diabetes. He would often just take the basal and miss the bolus and do around. So you know, I didn't realize the importance of all of that at the time. He was not coping very well with his diagnosis and diabetes. So then I started my nurse training, did my nurse training. I started working on a ward, because obviously once you've got somebody in your family with diabetes, you pay attention then to all of the sessions, all of the modules in nurse training, all about the diabetes. You know, that would be the ones that I'd prick, my ears would prick up, and I'd
You've got new you look at life with different glasses.
Yeah. So I learned a bit about diabetes, but nurse training, you don't learn very much. You learn the basics, type 1, type 2, basics of treatments, but you also learn the basics for everything else. So you're not an expert by any means, having done the basic nurse training. You know, you've got a gist of it, but not really, you're not an expert in diabetes. So then my first job as a qualified nurse was on a diabetes and endocrine ward. So it was mixed with gastro. So most of the patients were actually gastro patients, and then you get the odd person in DKA and newly diagnosed type 1s and things like that. So that was kind of my first nursing job. I did that for 3 years. I was the VAN 5, like newly qualified. Then I took over as a sister, which is like deputy in charge. Then I became the ward manager, but I never wanted to be the ward manager. I think my boss at the time went on maternity leave and she never came back, so I was like, I was promised it was only going to be for like 6 months while she was on mat leave, and she never came back. So all of a sudden I'm in charge of this ward, and I've only been qualified for like 3 years. So that was
wow.
Wanted to go and work in diabetes, so I kept nagging the diabetes nurses, have you got a job for me yet? But in diabetes, it's very difficult to actually get into it, because people tend to, once they're in it, they stay in it and they don't tend to leave, and so the jobs don't come up very often. And so actually getting into diabetes was quite tough. I had to take, you know, I applied three times, different jobs thing eventually, and I didn't have the qualifications, I didn't have anything, you know, because I was working on a ward. So and you don't get given the opportunities if you're not in the job, so it's like a catch-22 really. You need the qualifications to get into it, but if you're not in it, you don't get put on the courses. You get put on other courses like cannulation and venipuncture and all of the stuff you need for the ward.
Boring.
Although I'm very good at doing cannulas. That was one of my skills.
Well, that is important.
So whilst I was working on the diabetes ward, my sister had a baby, and then not long after her first baby, she got diagnosed with type 1. She was proper
DKA.
No, she was proper DKA. And I think that's when I realised I didn't know anything about managing diabetes day to day, because she'd be asking me questions, because my brother just kind of got on with it and didn't need me for anything. And whereas my sister was like 22 or 23, and she was like, what do I do? How do I do this? What happens? What's this about? You know, and all you really do on the ward is firefight. So like if somebody's got high blood sugars, you give them a dose of NovoRapid or whatever and check it in a couple of hours. And we deal with the emergency situations like DKA. So, you know, I could set you up an IV infusion. But day-to-day,
it's acute, it's reactive.
Yeah. Day-to-day management of type 1, you know, I was totally at my depth. So I realised I didn't really know very much about that. So you try and learn things on the ward, but it's very difficult when you work full-time, you've got a young family. So I didn't really learn anything until I moved into the job. So eventually she gave me a job in diabetes. So I was like a trainee diabetes specialist nurse. So I dropped down a band because I'd been ward managers, but I dropped down a band so that I could go work in diabetes, because that's what I wanted to do. I went and worked in inpatients, and I was doing that for about 8 or 9 months, and then I was going on holiday. I had 2 weeks off, and this is like the Saturday of my start of my 2 weeks holiday.
Yeah.
And I'm going to a birthday party for my sister's daughter, so niece, yeah. stepdaughter. Yeah. So my niece. Taking James. He's 7 at the time. And he never drinks fizzy drinks, so like Coke, lemonade, none of, you know, he's only 7, he didn't drink fizzy because it burns, you know, that's what he would say. It burns, I don't like it, it's too fizzy. You know, yeah. He'd only drink water, he'd drink squash, but he'd never drink glass. Yeah, he'd never drink anything fizzy. So we're at this birthday party and he's downing pints and pints of like orangeade, cherryade. And I thought it was like peer pressure. I thought it was like, what the hell, you know, he's never done this
before. Dared.
Yeah. But he was just drinking and drinking and drinking. And then he went to the toilet and it was like a litre of pee. And we were like, what on earth is going on? And I didn't even put two and two together at first. We're at my sister's house after the party and he's just laying around. You know, he's got a headache and he don't feel well and he's just laying around and tired and just sort of sleeping and on the sofa. But he's seven and he's been running around all day, you know, he didn't really think too much of it. But then I started thinking about it on the way home and I had a blood glucose meter that it was out of date, the strips were out of date. But it was just one that I'd been using to teach myself how to teach people. Mm-hmm. So it'd been in the cupboard and everything, you know, it'd all gone out of date. So you kind of think you're being neurotic because you work in it and you know, you see the symptoms and you think, oh, I'm just bringing my work home with me, you know, you feel like you're being a bit neurotic. But I was like, we're gonna have to test him because he's drinking loads, peeing loads.
So you're justifying your testing.
Yeah.
I'm not going mad, this is here, this is this and this is why we're doing it.
Yeah,
but I get
you've got a seven-year-old screaming the place down because you're about to prick his finger, and it didn't work the first time.
Oh, so
I had to do it, and I was like, oh my god, he's screaming the place down, absolutely screaming the place down. So eventually, we get some blood, and his blood sugar was 27.
Oh, poor James.
I know. And so I was like, oh, but the strips are out of date. So then Then I'm questioning myself. Also, he had loads of fizzy drink, and I'm like, "Is he got sugar on his hands? Is it contaminated?"
Yeah. You know,
I'm like, again,
I'm gonna do another one.
I'm being neurotic. It's not real. Yeah. Anyway, so we did another one, and it just came up high, no number, just high, after washing his hands.
Yeah.
So we then had to go to the hospital. So. We took him to the hospital, and I was, even on the way there, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to this hospital, and I was like, I'm glad because I don't live where I work. So I used to work in Medway and I live in East Kent. So I now work in East Kent, but I never did work in East Kent. So I was going to the William Harvey Hospital in Ashford. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad I don't work here, because what if I get there and it's not real? And I've just made up diabetes.
And you're working in diabetes at this time.
Yeah. So I was just like, oh, I feel like, what the hell, you know. But anyway, we got there.
But isn't that like I wasn't going to say a normal thing. Like, you'll hear any HCP who has a child with type 1, like that they're reluctant to react to the symptoms, because it's like, I don't know, you're almost, children of HCPs almost need to have a limb hanging off their body before they're actually taken. Like, you just, because you are like, no, it's not this, and it could be this, and it could be this, and this week, this week, it's okay, you're not dying, it's okay.
We got to the hospital when they did the blood sugar and it was like 33.3, but I think that's like the highest
we'll
read. Yeah.
Yeah.
And his ketones were 3 point something. So then had to do blood gas, and then they're like holding him down to get the blood gas. That was horrific. So they get the blood gas, and obviously being a diabetes nurse and working in inpatients, I know what the blood gas is meant to say and what's not meant to say. So obviously I'm like, oh, can I have a look? And they're like, what do you do again? What?
Oh, you're not working in this hospital too.
No. So yes. No. So then I'm like, oh, well, I'm a diabetes nurse like that. Oh, and he's like, oh, so you know what this is then? That was how they told me, and my son has type 1. Oh, you know what this is then? You know, your diabetes nurse. Oh, you can deal with this. It's fine. You know, but they treat me like a healthcare professional rather than a scared
parent.
Yeah. But that's it. Once you tell somebody
you are a diabetes nurse, you never have to tell another soul because you get to the ward, they all know.
Everybody knows.
You see the consultant, the pediatric consultant, he knows, everybody knows, because it's like, oh, mum's a diabetes nurse. And I'm like, yeah, but I've literally been in my job less than 9 months and I work in inpatient diabetes. It's massively different from dealing with type 1 day in, day out, 24/7.
But they don't know that.
No. So they just thought that I could just, and all my family as well, because, you know, you're a diabetes nurse, so you must know what to do. Everybody assumes you know what you're doing. So it was very tough the first few weeks because it was a steep learning curve. And also you have to be the kind of strong one. You have to be the person to teach everybody.
This sounds so familiar, Amanda, because when Johnny was diagnosed, like he was just turned six, and I had had type one for, I don't know, was it 15 years maybe, and maybe more. And it was a similar thing. You know what you're doing, but I don't know what diabetes is like outside of my body.
Yeah.
Like, and managing
and kids are so sensitive, aren't they? So like in hospital, so we, our first day out of hospital, his blood sugar was like 21. And in hospital, if somebody's blood sugar was that high, we'd probably give them about 5 or 6 units of insulin.
Oh my gosh.
I know. He needed one.
Yeah. There was a point where Johnny only, he didn't need a half and he couldn't take one. And that was the point where I was like, we need a pump here, or else I'm going to dilute this insulin. Like, and they're like, oh, you can't dilute the insulin. What am I going to do? Like, I'm giving him 2 breakfasts to go to.
Yeah,
they're so sensitive. And like, how was James with his first injection in the hospital?
Oh,
he's only 7.
I think I was worse.
Yeah.
They just hand me the pen, because obviously I know what I'm doing. I'm a nurse. I've done this a million times. So, you know, here you go. Here's the injection. You do the first injection. Oh, I was just shaking so much. Yeah. I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I just end up crying. He's crying. Dad's crying. All bloody crying.
Oh, you know.
It was so traumatic. And I feel like maybe this might be why he doesn't never want to inject in his tummy anymore, because that was like the first time I was trying to do it in his tummy.
Okay.
And I don't know whether it's like a trauma response. He will never inject in his tummy. He's never done it since that day.
Johnny was like that too, actually. And he now will inject in his tummy because that's the most accessible place for him to inject if something goes wrong with his pod. But like, we had an awful experience at the first jag too, because like I was upset and Adrian was upset and Johnny was upset. And then there was like the nurses who were like, will we hold him down? No, you're not holding him down. Like, I have to be able to do this when we go home. Like, he has to be able to trust me. And we did this from that point. I don't know. It was just, I think I had like an out of body experience when I was saying, I need to find a way that Johnny can trust me, that, and it was given him power. Because I remember, like, with me taking injections, had I got a pump, I had a pump at that point, it was like getting yourself ready to inject, and it might be sore in some places, and you take it out again. Or that, this is me using like a needle more than I should as well. And so it was, we did a thing where it was, mommy's ready, 3, 2, 1, and then Johnny would take a breath and he'd go, Johnny's ready, and I go,
yeah.
Okay, and we do it then, and he's in control. But it was that, will we hold him down? No, you can't hold him down, because this has to be done multiple times at home.
Yeah. The first few weeks on injections were really hard. He was screaming the place down, and we've got a dog, and she would just run away every time we even got the pen out, because she knew what was coming. She knew we were going to have some sort of meltdown hissy fit, because he had to have the injection. It's the same when he moved on to pump. When he got his first pump, that was 6 months into diagnosis. Every time we had to put a cannula in, he would just when you feel the pump and you get the cannula ready and you do the drop so you can see and you're ready to put the cannula in, you only get about 2 minutes until it times out and it starts screaming at you. But it takes longer than that for him to like take a breath and get ready, and you know, he'd be sitting there with his thing on his leg, and he'd want to push it, because if I push it, it hurts more. He wants to push it, but he just couldn't bring himself to push it. So yeah, there were many a times where I ended up having to do a cannula set change in his sleep because he just wouldn't do it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Same here.
And
yeah.
you feel horrific. You feel awful doing it. But it was like, it was that or nothing. You know, it was like either we're not going to get a set change at all, or you do it in his sleep. And, you know, that was awful. But I mean, it's all changed now. He does everything himself now. He's absolutely fine doing it all himself. He's 15.
Yeah. How did it change your perspective in your job then?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you realize exactly what it's like until you have it, until you're dealing with it 24/7. You don't appreciate the work that goes into it as a healthcare professional. I don't think you just don't.
You just don't know.
You've got book experience. So, you know, blood sugars are between 4 and 7. And they never go higher than that. And
yeah, doesn't matter how much you know.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was just listening on YouTube. I actually have a quick tip for kids, and I have tested this, and it seemed to work. But I only have a sample size of one for injecting in the tummy if they need to, and that was to let them poke around with a needle. Because it's what I do. I basically poke around with the needle, and wherever it's least sensitive, I know it's not going to hurt when I inject.
Yeah.
Like if I tap the needle against me without pushing it in and it almost hurts, then I know not to inject there because it's going to be painful.
Yeah.
Then letting the kid do that so that they can sort of, because everyone knows their own pain limits. Like if I pinch someone, I don't know if it's going to hurt or not, but if they pinch themselves, I know if it's going to hurt.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true, Norman.
And then obviously, then if they need, or they don't feel comfortable pushing it in, if they found a spot that isn't sensitive, then you can do it.
Yeah,
and I actually tested it on a kid that was diabetic of a friend of a friend of mine, and it seemed to work. But I only have a sample size of one, so I don't know if it works for everyone.
But I think
that makes sense.
Yeah, and we as adults, we would do something similar. Like we would, I will move the needle. Like if it is a bit more sensitive.
You just sort of tap it against your skin. You don't like push it in, but if it's sensitive, you know not to inject there. It's something I learned ages ago, but I actually had a chance to test it on a kid, and it seemed to work. So,
good point.
There you go.
Thing with the cannula though, it's up in like this carriage thing, isn't it? When you pull it back, it's like up in the air, so you wouldn't be able to touch anywhere with that. I
don't have any experience with pumps in that way, but definitely for pens.
Yeah.
So I'm looking through Flipper's questions because they're fab. Do you think, like, and you've kind of hinted at this, like, as well with how like the news spread through the hospital, like, but do you feel that there was assumptions that you already knew everything?
And also you put pressure on yourself as well. Think, you know, you have to have everything right because this is your job. This is your job as a parent. This is your job as a healthcare professional. And you really put pressure on yourself to make everything perfect. And I did. Everything was perfect for a while.
Did you take it all on yourself as well?
This was before we had sensors. So when James was 7, there were no Libras or we didn't have the CGM or anything. So you'd be waking up all through the night checking finger pricks, no sleep. And so I don't think you realise how much sleep affects your your thinking, your thought processes, your everything. Just having a child with type 1 and not having sensors or CGM was like being continuously sleepwalking throughout life.
Yeah, like you set alarms on your phone. You've multiple alarms on your phone, and like you have to delete them to create more.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're always random times as well, because you know, like something's happened at 11:59 and you know you want to check it again in 2 hours, so you've got like a 1:59 alarm.
I know. Exactly. Or you've got like, you do have the 15-minute one as well, like, and because you've treated the load, you're confident you've treated it, but like you want to see it coming up because sometimes it just doesn't come up as fast. No, but you're so tired.
Yeah, I've sat in his room many a night with a hypo waiting 15 minutes to recheck to make sure he's come up before going back to sleep. They're the worst ones, because at least the high, you can treat the high and you can go back to sleep for a couple of hours because you know it's going to take a while to come down. But with the low, you've got to try and stay awake for 15 minutes to recheck. And then if it hasn't come up the second time, you've got to try, you've got to do it again for another 15 minutes. So Twitter at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Quite interesting.
I know. Here, tell us about your diagnosis then.
So mine's really boring. Well, I mean, yeah, I suppose it is a little bit interesting.
None of it's boring.
Well, I have a big family history of type 1 diabetes, which is my brother, my sister, my my son. We were doing a thing. So me and Beth were doing like a webinar thing because it was COVID 2020. Everything was virtual. So we were doing like a virtual conference for diabetes professional care. And they were doing this like campaign to find the missing millions of people. They were looking for people with type 2 diabetes, missing millions. And their slogan was like, test one drop. And so me and her, I don't know, we were just mucking about. We tested our own blood sugars. And mine was 14.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, ooh. And I'm like, Beth, what the hell? It's 14. Well, it's not supposed to be that high. She's like, what have you eaten? You know, and then we had to like go through and like we're trying to work out, was that normal? Was that not normal? No, it's not normal.
Questioning your own.
I know. And honestly, it really did make me question the difference between type 1 and type 2 and everything. I really like was like, this is ridiculous. How can I have this? I had no symptoms.
Because it was so
I just caught it by chance.
And had you eaten something the previous hour or something like that, and that was just what spiked in?
I don't even remember. I know that after that I work in hospital with consultants and whatnot, and I just said, you know, I did this yesterday and this happened. So I did a fasting. The fasting was like 7.5, and then I was like, oh, so then I'm looking up what's the normal fasting, what was pre-diabetes, and it looked like I had kind of like pre-diabetes. So I was like, oh my god, COVID, I've put loads of weight on, I'm like, I've got type 2.
Oh dear.
I'm like, I'm gonna have to go on a diet, I'm gonna have to go and, you know, do some exercise, because we'd all been locked in our houses for ages, haven't we? And nobody was doing anything, everybody was kind of all the things we tell people, you know, sedentary lifestyle, eating too much alcohol, you know. I was like, right, I think I'm going on diet. So I decided to go on like a shake smoothie type diet for about a month, and I stuck a Freestyle Libre on just to see what my post-meal rises were like. And actually, on the really like low carb, low calorie diet, the post meal only went to sort of 10, but these meals are like 20 grams of carbs and my blood sugar is still going
to 10. Yeah.
20 grams of carbs. So it wasn't right. But I was,
did you test your C-peptide or anything?
Yeah. So what happened was I sent off antibodies, but they take 4 or 5 weeks to come back. Whilst you're waiting, I was like thinking, because it wasn't normal. So normal, that what I'd seen, my brother, my sister, my son, normal diagnosis of type 1 is, you know, chaotic, you know, dramatic, really quick onset, really high symptoms, dry mouth, peeing lots, all of that kind of stuff. And I was fine. I was absolutely fine. And so I was like, this can't be type 1. This must be type 2, because I feel fine. So it got to about 4 or 5 weeks, and I was chasing my blood test result, because they send them off to Exeter. Mm-hmm. So it takes ages to get done and come back. So I'm chasing the blood results, and I'm getting my secretary, my consultant secretary, to kind of chase the lab and trying to find out where they were. And I just got really annoyed waiting for them. So I messaged the point of care testing team at the hospital, and I was like, people shouldn't have to wait this long for results. This is just, you know, I can't think of the word, but like, you know, it's not good enough. It's just not good enough. Why do people
have to wait? It's not acceptable.
Yeah, it's not acceptable. You know, I was a proper ranting. I know, because I was stressed out. I was waiting to find out whether I had, you know,
a type 1 or type 2 or what. I messaged somebody at the hospital and she messaged me back saying, oh, can you give me the patient's name and I'll check it for you.
Can I just give you the number?
Oh, confession.
It's me.
It's still unacceptable.
Yeah, but it's still unacceptable, yes.
And then she was like, oh, let me go. Let me find out. And then she got the result. Obviously, she's not allowed to tell me because I'm the patient.
Oh, sugar lumps.
I know. So she's got the result and she sends it to my consultant. And then my consultant's off sick with COVID. So I'm like, oh. So he's got an email sitting there waiting for him with my results on it. So I'm just sitting waiting anyway. So I messaged him and I'm like, can you please open your, I know you're ill.
How are you feeling?
I know you're off sick. And you've got COVID and you're really not well, but please, this is about me now. Can you open your email and can you read and see what my results are? And I think he was so sick that he didn't even put a message in the message that he forwarded. He literally just forwarded the results to me.
Oh my goodness.
And without any kind of context, any kind of support, any kind of anything. It was proper harsh.
Rubbish.
So I just again got this email and it just said GAD positive 535. The other ones were negative, but the GAD was positive. And and it says consistent with type 1 diabetes. So I just cried my eyes out.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know why I thought it would be anything else, but you kind of have it in your mind that
maybe it's not.
because I was so well. I'm so well. But you know, when you get diagnosed as an adult, you can get, it used to be called LADA, but it's slow evolving autoimmune. So it's a form of type 1, but it's very slow onset. And
is it not called LADA anymore?
Well, they don't call it that anymore. World Health Organization changed the name to something really random, like I don't even know. It's really like really long.
Okay.
But we all know it as LADA. Everybody still calls it LADA, but officially LADA is not a real name. So they call it type 1, type 2. So if it's autoimmune, it's type 1. If it's, you know, if it's more lifestyle, then it's type 2. So, you know, it's autoimmune, but it's slow evolving.
This must really have changed your perspective then on in your job on top of James's.
Yeah, like, yeah. And because I'm like messaging consultants now going, how is this possible? I'm well.
Yeah. And what if your GAD wasn't positive and you, because I know that there are ones out there who are treated exactly like they need to be treated exactly like they have type 1, but they don't have positive autoantibodies.
Yeah, so there's about I think it's like 84% will have positive antibodies and there's like about 16% or something that don't. I don't know the exact numbers, so don't quote me on that, but it's roughly that sort of split. So even if you don't have positive antibodies, you can still have type 1 diabetes. But if you do have positive antibodies, then it's definitely type 1. When you look at the type 1 consensus document, you follow down to see whether you've got MODY or whether you've got type 2 or whether you've got type 1, you know, and antibody positive type 1, and you're straight on that. You know,
it really, it makes it clearer, but it's less clear for those who don't then, and they just have to fight for their access then to care.
Yeah.
Probably.
So I started insulin then. I hadn't been taking insulin up until then. So I'd been 5 weeks just diet controlled, trying to lose weight and treat my pre-diabetes.
And you hadn't lost any weight? You hadn't noticed any weight loss or anything like that?
No. I don't think I would have known for another year, maybe another 6 months to a year. I don't think I would have known. I think it's so slow. I don't think I would have known at all. It's only because I did the finger prick that I found it. And then obviously then you go and send off. And I don't know what's worse, because I feel like I was waiting for something to happen. I feel like I was kind of in this limbo land where it was like
waiting for the chaos.
Yeah. You're like, I'm still waiting for the chaos.
That's good. Well, not good that you're waiting, but like, yes, good that it's not chaotic. Like this is 2020 and we're all falling apart a little bit. You guys had an awful time of it and now you have this on top of it and not really
that great, like, of an introduction to type 1 with James. And like, how did you feel? Like, how did you cope?
I mean, I cried my eyes out when I first, because I thought, you know, I thought things were going to change really quickly. I thought everything was just going to, I thought it was going to be, you know, really quick, because that's my whole experience had been type one is quick onset. You know, this is what the book says. Why is the book not doing, what am I not doing what the book says?
And you're waiting for the new normal and like to switch
and
into.
It's just it's still, you know, I guarantee I've still got some insulin production. So, you know, it's too.
That's good.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, they say you can have it for like 6-10 years, you know, but this is what happens to some people. So I looked after a person who quite clearly was type one, but she didn't look like a type one. And so the GP had put her on medications for type 2 diabetes, and she'd been on these medications for 9 years.
Wow.
And then everything went off. Her HbA1c was really high. Everything was kind of like a bit, you know, just didn't make sense. So I sent off her antibodies and they came back positive. And she actually had type 1 diabetes, but it was because it was so slow, it looked like type 2. And that's what happens to a lot of people who have got like LADA type 1 diabetes. You know, you don't always get your diagnosis straight away. It can be, you know, a few years down the line when people realize, actually, no, this isn't type 2. Because most people who get diabetes at 40, it is type 2. Mm-hmm. So you don't, you know, you think that if you don't fit the classic pattern, like you would expect, you know, the weight loss, your ketones, you're in hospital, is dramatic. You know, if you don't fit that kind of, your GP is gonna think type 2.
Yeah.
It's only because I work in the hospital and because I have a son and a brother and a sister that I had antibodies checked. Other people may not have pushed for that.
Or even know to push for it even too, and are almost happy for to just go with the flow because it's so overwhelming. Any diabetes diagnosis, like it's slowly like explained to us. I know it, with the chaotic type one, you learn really fast, but you still only learn a little bit really fast. You're not given everything. So you mentioned you have a pump. When did James start on a pump after 6 months? What about you then?
Yeah, so I moved hospitals because I was working in Medway and now I work in East Kent. So obviously I work with my consultant now. So I can see my consultant, you know, I'm quite lucky. So, you know, I'm not sure I would have had it otherwise.
There's no luck in all this.
Jeez. Yeah, I know. I feel like that. You feel like that, but I know that a lot of people haven't got access to technology. So I am very lucky, and I understand that. But
what are the main things that you like about pumping? Even if you've got a less chaotic type one at the minute, like what's that like? Do you find
it's just because I'm quite sensitive to insulin? Yeah. I think it just helps with the precise. It's like what we were saying with James when he was younger, you know, he used one unit to bring him down and stuff. You know, I'd have a really high carb ratio, you know, and really low basal rates. It's I think it helps to not be hyper all the time.
Yes, and you function better.
Yeah.
And I know you're using a G6 with your have you linked that into Control IQ?
So I have just for the last few weeks I've been playing about with it.
Proper testing.
Like guinea pigging myself. But I found actually my time in range is better, but my average glucose level's gone up, because I think I was keeping myself very tight, and it was like 5, you know, I'd wake up on 5 and I'd stay at 5 for like in between meals, I'd be quite low. But with the Control IQ, obviously it targets you to 6. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to 5 now. So my average glucose is higher, but I'm also not getting those postprandial highs, so after meal highs.
Brilliant.
So it's because it's jumping in before you get there. So like if you've not done enough bolus for that meal, it's given you an automatic correction before it gets to 10.
Yeah.
And so you're not getting there. So that's been good, because you wouldn't think to do it yourself half the time, because you think, oh, it's going to come down itself, you know.
I know. And you're like, do you know, if I do give myself extra, I will plummet and then I'll go high.
Yeah. So yeah, but this is giving you like 0.5 of a unit.
Yeah.
And it's enough.
Here's the thing. Do you think, right, you're so insulin sensitive still, do you think having a closed loop will prolong that period?
Well, this is one of the questions I ask, because I know a lot of people in diabetes. And,
yeah, I think Roman is looking at this. Roman Hovorka was looking at something similar. Yeah.
I don't think there's very much evidence to say that it does anything to the autoimmune, because obviously it's an autoimmune progression. Your body is attacking your pancreas, and whether you are injecting insulin or not injecting insulin, it's not going to slow down the autoimmune process, as far as I'm aware. But, you know, I would love to see some studies on it, but I don't think, you know, but all it's doing is it's meaning that, you know, I'm not going out of range. I'm keeping things in quite a good target range. So those risks of complications later in life have been minimized. So that's a good thing. I've got a long time to live, hopefully.
So just even on that, like a segue with that kind of like researchy stuff, with all the type one in your family, do you have any other children, or just do you?
Yeah, so I have two other children. Touch wood, they don't have any signs.
You thought of about Elsa.
Diabetes. My daughter doesn't need that. she won't go anywhere near a needle, so I'd never get any blood from her to start with. And two, if there was and it's like this limbo thing. It's like, do you want to know if it's going to happen? Do you want to know? Because if there's nothing we can do to prevent it, I know there's trials and stuff, but you know, nothing concrete that's going to help. And it's like, otherwise you're in that limbo land waiting for your inevitable, you know, to when your pancreas stops working or what's going to happen. You just, I think she didn't want to know, and neither did my other daughter. So they'd rather live in denial until it happens, if it happens. But every time they get ill, every time they're cold, every time they're drinking a bit too much, every time they've lost a bit of weight, I'm like, give me your finger.
I could totally relate. And until we have teplizumab here, like we don't have Elsa in Northern Ireland yet, and until we have teplizumab, what is the point? But it is torture.
But then I suppose you have to be selfless, I suppose, because even if it's not going to help you, it will help other people, and it will help the future of type one. But
but it's individual.
Yeah
I think like your family story is it's almost like it's not surprising.
And my brother was the first one. There's nobody before him. Nobody in my family has that before him. So
we've two others outside of our family as well with type one. Not siblings of mine, but like cousins. But it's funny where it doesn't appear in other families. And you're the sole person, like your brother, the first person, and nobody behind him. And then what happened?
Yeah, I don't know. I blame my dad.
That's on my dad's side as well. It actually is. Yeah. But anyways, what else have I got here? Okay, I think Tom, are you there? You still crunching your ginger nuts?
I'm still I've had two. My sugars are currently at 11.4, so just over an hour. So it's gone from about 8 to 11.4. Shall we maybe go to the next sort of topic area?
I'm just aware of the time, and I know that like we kind of touched on loads a wee bit.
Absolutely. There. And I think what we'll do is we'll have a look at this section together, and I think what I would really love, Amanda, is that we get you, Beth, and the team back at a later stage in the year, where we can come back and we can talk a lot more in detail about Diabetes Specialist Nurse Forum and the Diabetes 101 and a lot more detail.
Absolutely, because I think that is
just a brilliant chat on its own, because I think it's really been fascinating tonight, It's been great having you and Mary bounce off each other. So just for people that don't really know about the Diabetes Specialist Nurse Forum, what is it and how did you get involved in it? And I know you've been part of it for a while and part of the team that got the QIC. Would you like to maybe mention a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I set the DSN forum up in 2018. Basically, I was a new DSN. I'd been qualified I'd been in my job for 2 or 3 years, but my boss retired and kind of left me to lead the department. And I was out on a limb. I just was kind of like, didn't have a peer support network. Yeah. I didn't know any real diabetes nurses. So we go to conferences, as you know. And I'd met a few people at a few conferences and made friends and sort of like, we need a way to kind of link up and share things and stuff. So I looked to see if there was a Facebook group. I thought there might be a Facebook group for diabetes specialist nurses. There's loads of like practice nurse groups, but no diabetes specialist nurse group. So I set up a Facebook group with just like 5 or 6 of us in it at the beginning. And then it literally took a week and there was 300 members. And I just didn't realise that there was such a need for it, that everybody needed this connection. Yep. Because we were all working on our own in silos and not really sharing things and not really learning from each other and not really helping each other. So that's kind of where it started. We've now got 2,100 members, something like that. So it's a really big Facebook group. So that's like a closed forum for diabetes specialist nurses. So people that work solely in diabetes are in that closed group. Mm-hmm. But we found that a lot of other healthcare professionals wanted to try and join our group. But I was like, but this is a peer support group for diabetes specialist nurses. The things that we're dealing with are not going to be the same as the things that the practice nurses are dealing with or the doctors are dealing with. This is just our place. Yeah, we decided to set up other things for practice nurses, like an open page, which is where we live stream our brunches, and a Twitter page and Instagram and all of the rest of TikTok. That's funny. And podcasts and all of that. So we basically, over the last 4 years, we've kind of got onto every single social media site to kind of just share things that get shared in the forum. So if somebody's got a really good, so like there was this preconceptual care poster that Blackpool shared, and they'd spent the time, they'd made it was really good, they made like a PDF of it, and it was and we could share it, and we shared it up and down the country. Yep. So now that nobody else had to spend that time writing that preconceptual thing, you know, everybody had access to it. So that's what the forum is. It's about sharing things that other people are doing so that everybody gets to learn from each other and we all kind of can support each other.
And we've seen some amazing visuals that you guys have been part of, haven't you?
Comparison charts.
They're just so informative, and just it's nice to see it just there. And you see the conferences and you see the people tweeting along, and you can see your amazing comparison charts on show. And it's just you must be proud to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's Vicky's baby, Vicky Alababra. That's her baby. She spent hours getting the font right and getting the sectioning just right and everything, colours and whatnot.
I was going to say, all those things take so much time, even and just sharing them.
People then say, oh, actually, can you just add this? Can you just add that? Can you just add this?
Can I just?
Yeah. And they're just like, no, there is no space left on this page.
Yeah. And they are awesome.
And now you've got the DSN Forum podcast as well, haven't you? How good is that? Like, tell us a little bit about that.
We are on Twitter 24/7. Beth has been like, what's the limit reached?
Rate exceeded.
Yeah, for like the last 2 days, she's driving her nuts. But we get to see, and we follow a lot of people. So we get to see a lot of the news, and people tag us in stuff as well. So we're not just out there looking all the time. People do tag us in stuff as well. So we find out a lot about what's going on in the diabetes world, and there's so much going on. You don't even realize how much goes on in a couple of weeks. So we have another group chat. Me and Beth are in like 59 group chats together, but we set up a separate group chat for
podcast news. So anytime anything happens on Twitter or someone tags us in something, we take a screenshot of it and it goes in the news podcast thing. Yep. And then every 2 weeks, either me and Beth or Tamsin and Vicky will just kind of read out all the different things that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, and we do special ones. So like this week it was the ADA, and there was just way too much to put in one podcast, so we did a special edition ADA podcast, so that we could put all the ADA stuff in one and then the news in the other one. So we did two podcasts in like 3 days.
I love the ADA one, and I, you know, when I was listening along, I kind of thought, you know, this is how those of us who can't go to conferences,
yep,
how we try and soak up the information, like, yeah, like listening to you guys talking, like we couldn't get to go, but like this is like we follow a lot of people that we trust, and like this, yeah, is like I was just listening along going, oh yeah, that's a bit what like how I'm trying to learn, and there's you guys where you can't go to those that are so far away, like there's no budget or but and even further outside of the UK, like DSNs and people working in diabetes can't attend conferences as a norm. Having that from you guys in one place will be so helpful for them. Like,
yeah, we have a really big following now. We get quite a few listens each week. So if you haven't subscribed, please do. It's on all the normal sites, because you just do it on Anchor and it sends it out to all the different podcast things. So we only have to record it on one thing and it gets sent out to everywhere, so pretty much anywhere you can listen to a podcast you can probably find it, and it's just Diabetes Specialist Nurse Forum UK.
Do you get data about how many countries, like,
yeah, it's all over the world.
Yeah,
it's like with me and Beth are quite analytic nerds. We like to look how far things have reached.
Yeah,
how many views you've had, how many listens you've had, how many of everything. Yeah, when the GLP-1 shortage happened the other day, we had something like 33,000 impressions on Twitter for one tweet. So yeah, we're probably,
but that was a good tweet. That,
yeah, well, it's unfortunately, the news in it was not good, but
no, yeah,
I guess then it gives you like time where you can, Beth and the team can sit aside and go, actually this is what the community want, this is the interest that people are interested in, and then you can go away and talk about it and then educate us guys. So obviously this project you do is alongside your day job and family life and diabetes and James's life, so a big like hats off to like
I'm a bit
you
mental.
Team.
Yeah.
like Mary said in the intro, Flipper's intro, you are a person of wearing many hats, aren't you? You've literally you're doing everything. Bless you.
I've got all the hats.
What about the diabetes 101 then? So obviously I think we'll definitely come back to this in a special chat, I think, but what is the diabetes 101? How did it come about? And what sort of things did you do to help and support the community, especially during the pandemic? Cause that's when it was established, wasn't it?
Yeah. So as the pandemic hit in like the March of 2020. We were seeing lots of panic on Twitter. We were seeing lots of people getting very stressed about what should they be doing. Should they be isolating? Should they be wearing masks? Should they be doing XYZ? And the government kind of advice was getting muddled with other people's advice and scaremongering and stuff. So it was just, we just wanted to be a level head. So Partha was getting tweets left, right and center and getting messages, you know, what should I do, you know, panicky stuff, and so were we. So we kind of decided, me, Beth and Partha, that we would set up a new Twitter account, and it would just show the most accurate information at the time. Obviously it was changing all the time, so every week it was changing, so you know, we just wanted to make sure that if we were all getting messages, we could go, right, follow 101, you will get the most up-to-date stuff. So we couldn't do it on our own because we were working full-time.
Yeah,
everyone else was on there, you know, what was it called? Furlough. Yeah. Everyone was having fun, weren't they? We're all in their gardens in the sunshine.
I wish
working full-time. So we set up the account, and we were manning it as a Q&A as well.
Yeah.
So like between 10 and 12 and 2 and 4, somebody would be in charge of the Twitter accounts. We got, it was about 19 of us together in the another group chat. There's about 19 healthcare professionals, or pharmacists, mainly nurses, ophthalmology, psychology, Dr. Ray Stewart, GPs, consultants, you know, so just everything you can think of. We didn't have a podiatrist, we wish we had, but we didn't get one of those.
And you did so many amazing things, didn't you? You did like infographics, you did sort of mini videos. I know you did quiz stuff as well.
But the Big Bank Holiday quizzes.
But I just think it was just a lifeline for people, because I actually wasn't aware of it at the time. But looking back now and hearing about it and hearing from our community and just seeing how it helped so many people, because in that time, in that pandemic, everyone, like you say, was just frightened, and we've sort of lost that connection, disconnection with our hospital teams. And even you hear now, like, people are still like only kind of getting around to maybe seeing their teams maybe for the first time since the pandemic in person. So you guys are a lifeline. You were the first point of call, I guess. Like you say, you had the up-to-date information, but you were just our sort of safety blanket, weren't you?
We did tutorials on all the normal sort of things that you would do in your kind of annual review, like foot checks, blood pressure, diet, exercise, you know, anything that we could think of, because we had all that expertise in the group, so they could all do a tutorial. So tutorials are basically, it's a slide deck, and you set it up on Hootsuite, so you get a new slide every 5 minutes, and then you can just have a chat around it. So we go, it's going to start at 8 and it might roll till like 9, and you'll just have a new slide every 5 minutes, and then people can ask questions on the slide. And and then we downloaded all of them and we had them on a website, but we were paying for two websites. So we've merged it all into the DSM forum. So the DSM forum website has all the 101 stuff on the website. So you can still access it, but it's on our website now rather than having two separate ones.
Those tutorials are amazing, really clear as well. And I think you can see, like, with like James's Thursday tweets, it's something maybe even simpler for the diabetes community, but in a similar kind of, just broken down very clearly.
Yeah.
Really informative.
And we did a conference as well. We did a whole day on a Saturday when we all took a session. We had about 100 people turn up to that virtually, where we did, like, each session was done. And we recorded all of them. They're all on YouTube. And so Diabetes 101 has its own YouTube channel. So all the videos from the conference are on there as well.
So
it is brilliant.
So obviously you do the DSM brunches as well. What are they? Please share with us.
So basically, anytime something interesting comes along, so we don't have like a set standard, we will do a brunch every month or 2 months or whatever. We just do it when something interesting comes along. So if we've been speaking to somebody, or there's somebody really interesting that we want to talk to, we'll invite them to a brunch. And basically we record on Zoom and we live stream on Facebook. And it's just a chit chat like this, you know, so you'll get speakers up and you'll have a conversation, but because it's live streamed, people on Facebook, because we've got about 3,000 followers on our open page, they can comment underneath, and we can ask the questions direct to the speakers. So that it works really well. We get quite a few views on those at the time, and also people then can catch up later.
Absolutely. No, yeah. That's great, isn't it? Having that sort of live discussion where people can have that Q&A and talk to some amazing people, or, like you say, listen back, which is great. Have you, I think we're going to go into a more in-depth discussion. I think we need to catch up with you and your partner in crime, Beth, and we'll set up a chat in the future. But have you got any exciting projects lined up? I'm sure you have. For the future,
our biggest thing this year is our first conference. We've done one with the heart failure nurses and the renal nurses called HEF Friends, which is heart failure, renal, diabetes, and it's HEF Friends. But anyway, we have the Friends theme tune and stuff playing. So that's all the diabetes, renal nurses and heart failure nurses. So we've done that conference, and we were like, actually, we want to do our own diabetes nurse conference. So that is in October. And we've got something ridiculous, like 240 people signed up to it. So that's going to be massive. And we're really excited about that.
And is that, like you say, kind
of taking up all our time at the moment?
Yeah. And like you say, is that exclusive for people who are
DSMs? Yeah, so diabetes specialists. Yeah. So, I mean, they don't have to be nurses, but people that specialise in diabetes, because it's quite high level kind of talks. We've got really good speakers. So we've got like the Helen Murphy, who's like the queen of midwifery, the lady that got everybody CGMs in pregnancy. We've got Philip Newland Jones, we've got Jerry Raymond, we've got Partha.
And you're talking as well, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about sex.
Oh, love that. someone actually came on the diving. Oh, wow.
That's just a warning.
Oh,
someone actually came on the diabetes chat a few weeks ago, and I was talking about sex and diabetes, and we didn't get actually into the flow of it. So I think if you ever want to do a diabetes chat special, yeah. Amanda, we know we'll be coming to you.
Yeah, well, because I did my dissertation on the impact of wearable diabetes technology on sexual activity, like, you know, alarms and,
oh my goodness,
stuff. And yeah, so I'm in the process. My professors at King's have got my transcript at the moment, and they're ripping it to shreds to make it good enough for publication. But it will be published at some point. But yeah, they take ages to look it all up and make it sound academic.
So maybe to finish, and then we'll definitely connect up to talk about future chat nights and collaborations, is what is your hope and your aspirations for yourself and diabetes care and management for us guys, the community, like children, adults, people living with diabetes, or people supporting those with diabetes? What's your hopes and aspirations for the future?
Yeah, I mean, we'd all love a cure, wouldn't we? I think that's always got to be number one. But I think people have been set talking about the cure ever since diabetes was a thing. And it's always been sort of 10 years, isn't it, till we get cured. But, you know, in the meantime, technology is probably the closest we're going to get at the moment to being able to live more normal lives, more like other people. So, yeah, better technology. And then ultimately a cure.
Can I ask a last question, Tom? Can I ask the last question of Amanda? Because ADA has just passed, and with DDoC, and we started talking about DDoC at the start, and the Jazz and Renza brought out stigma and a really good piece written about it. Sorry, my words are all jumbled and all over the place. But Amanda, you wear so many hats, and you meet so many people with all different kinds of diabetes. How can we tackle like those social stigmas that are there? And what do you think the role of the community is to reduce that diabetes stigma from you as not just as a DSM, but you immersed in it with all those hats?
Yeah. I mean, it's awareness, isn't it? I think a lot of diabetes stigma is because people are just clueless as to what it is and why people develop and stuff. And, you know, so I think raising awareness, and that's, you know, kind of what we do with the forum, trying to get people to understand differences and, you know, just... tell, and like, it's like you can't go out without being stopped if you've got a Libra or a sensor or something on your arm, and you know, you can shy away from it, or you can teach people all about it, and one more person that knows about it, tell somebody else about it, that's, you know, raising awareness, kind of helping to get other people to understand what.
That's so true. It's not, yeah. it is people aren't just don't know, they like, it's maybe old information, or it's not,
the media doesn't help as well.
No,
because the headlines are always sensationalized to make it sound, you know, horrific. So,
like you brought it on yourself or you're to blame.
Yeah.
It's your fault. You have a choice.
I do also think sometimes that healthcare professionals back in the day also thought, you know, you're not managing. Well, why isn't it working? Because, you know, your blood sugars should be 4 to 7. Why are they not 4 to 7? What are you doing wrong?
What are you not doing that I'm telling you that you should be doing?
Yeah. Because I've had it with inpatient nurses where I've gone to a ward and a person's had all their treats taken away from them because they can't have them because they have diabetes. And their blood sugars are really high and they're going, oh, it's because she's been eating X, Y, Z. Yet the nurses have been giving the patient steroids every morning. and their blood sugars are through the roof in the evening because they're on steroids. It's nothing to do with the food that they've eaten. It's the steroids that you gave them this morning for breakfast. Yeah, so you know, even with healthcare professionals, it's there's so much awareness that needs doing out there, and that's part of the forum. That's part of why we do the forum.
Right, I love you even more. I'm done. That was my big one.
That was a big one.
No, a massive topic. I'm sure we could talk for hours. Just on that, really, and maybe in the open forum chat in a sec we'll go into that. But honestly, it's been such a fascinating chat tonight. Thank you so much, Amanda. Thank you for everything you do for the online community, but also as a DSN for your team, and like we've said, wearing all them amazing hats and helping so much. Please go check out, guys, Amanda on Twitter and the DSN forum on Facebook. And all their details are on their website as well. And we will connect up and do another chat, I'm sure, around the DSN forum, Diabetes 101, and lots more, I hope. But honestly, thank you so much. And a big thank you to Flipper as well.
Thank you to Flipper.
Yeah, for setting up tonight and setting up the questions and trusting me and Mary to host tonight.
No.
I think we did all right, Mary.
I think we did okay. Amanda, you were amazing, and thank you for your time, and thanks for all that you do. I don't know how you do it. I don't know. I do have other questions, like how.
Why are you so mental?
how do you mind yourself? How do you mind yourself? And maybe it's because I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, diabetes was my thing before. My son was diagnosed, before I was diagnosed, you know, diabetes was my passion. So, and it doesn't change just because you get a diagnosis or your child gets a diagnosis. It was always, you know, people love to work in diabetes. People that work in diabetes absolutely love to work in diabetes. So
why is that?
I don't know. It's like Marmite. It's either you love it or you hate it.
It's not like any other condition, because it's you work with the same people. We don't go away.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know. It's that vacation.
No, but I think it is. And there's that other bit, like, where the consultants, like anybody who's nursing is a vocation, isn't it? Like, it's always considered as a vocation.
Mm-hmm.
But being a consultant isn't necessarily considered as a vocation, but being a diabetes consultant, that's a vocation. And like, there's bits of that, like, that are like, they're trying to connect, like, people, like, them to, like, where they're more mechanical about medicine and less vocational about it. You kind of do need that with diabetes.
Yeah,
you guys are amazing, especially, no, you're all amazing, I was going to say, especially DSNs. Don't tell the consultants, I think you're better.
They say it too. Path is always saying stuff like that, that they were the linchpins of diabetes care.
You are, like, you're the ones that we will ask the silly questions of, and not,
and we don't mind.
Yeah,
ask silly questions, because it's better to ask, and we say, no, don't worry about it.
I know, but you're terrified in the consultant's room. One, because it's not a, like, you're trying to go in with, like, good questions as well. Like, you've only got so many, so it needs to be a valuable one.
Yeah.
No, use their class. You make our lives so much better.
You're welcome.
Thank you.